comic books, movies, TV, and more. Nerds are everywhere. It's time to assemble! It's Nerds United, a Jittery Monkey podcast. Here's your host, Greg Mahochko.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Nerd Dome, episode 21 of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. Greg Mahochko here, and for episode 21, we're turning the dials back to episode 1, and fortunate enough that I get to sit down with my very first guest that I ever had. If you go back to early June 2013, a young Greg Mahochko. No, not that much younger. Obviously, just a year ago. But I got a link sent to me on Twitter that told me that there was a Nebraska native, former University of Nebraska journalism major and student, and now he was writing for DC Comics, Green Lantern Corps. I said, well, hitting Green Lantern and hitting Nebraska, that's two of the big ones. I've got to try to track him down, and I was able to. He was my guest on the very first episode of Nerds United, and I'm so thankful that he's willing to take some of his time out of his busy schedule to join me for episode 21 as we welcome back Van Jensen. Van, welcome. How are you, sir?
Good. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for agreeing to come back. So far, you're the only one who's ever agreed. No, I'm kidding.
we'll see how this one goes, you know.
The last one went well, and we learned certainly about the history of Van Jensen, and so we don't have to necessarily go over all of that again, but if somebody's tuning in for the first time, we're going to give it the old Stan Lee Marvel treatment. From Western Nebraska, you went to the University of Nebraska and wrote for the newspaper there. You got your, I believe, first journalism job at a newspaper in Arkansas?
Yeah, that's right. The Arkansas Democrat Gazette in Little Rock.
And from there, you met up with a gentleman who you would go to become co-creators of a comic book known as Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, which we're going to talk a little bit more about. But that's where your friendship, your relationship started with Dusty Higgins, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually were just at a Heroes Con in Charlotte together over this past weekend, which I guess marks 6 years since the debut of Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. So it was, you know, great kind of celebrating a little anniversary of that.
And from Arkansas, then you went to Georgia, correct?
Yep, to Atlanta.
And and I know that you've been doing some magazine work for Georgia Tech.
Yeah. Up until March, I was the editor of Georgia Tech's Alumni Magazine, which, you know, was a great gig, but I had the opportunity to write comics full time, and I figured I'd be quite the fool if I passed up on that chance.
And as far as, would you say that Green Lantern Corps was your first big opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that was my first gig doing superhero comics, the first time I did monthly comics, first time working for one of the big two superhero publishers. So, yeah, I guess that could qualify as my big break, though. I don't know. I feel like I still, you know, barely have a toehold in comics. So I'm kind of every issue that comes out, I'm just trying to, you know, learn and do a little bit better than the last one.
So refresh our memories then. How did you go from, you know, just kind of you were doing the vampire, the Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, and then you went. How did that transition go? How did you get approached or make your presence known to DC?
Really, you know, part of it was just having the Pinocchio Vampire Slayer books out, and then part of it was really, you know, having the right friends in the right places, I guess. I got to be friends with Robert Venditti, who is, you know, a great writer who, He does EXO Manowar for Valiant, had done the Surrogates for Top Shelf, and he got hired at DC first to do Demon Knights and then to take over Green Lantern from Geoff Johns, of course. And Rod passed along copies of my books to the editors there. And when Green Lantern Corps came open, they, you know, were willing to take a shot on me.
And you started out on Green Lantern Corps. Were you kind of co-writing that with Robert, right?
Yeah. So it was one of those things where, you know, DC, the higher level editors, they had no idea who I was. And my direct editors, they wanted just to hire me and have me on the book. But the higher level editors, you know, wanted to have Rob on it as well, in part because, you know, they knew him, they trusted his work, and they just hadn't worked with me before, which is totally understandable. So Rob co-plotted the book for the first, I guess, 6 or 7 issues together. And he was so, so helpful over that period just in, in a lot of ways, he was almost an extra editor. And he had been doing, you know, monthly superhero comics for a couple of years at that point. And he was really able to, you know, show me the ropes and teach me all the little things that make life a lot easier, because it's as much fun as it is a lot of work.
I guess maybe a good starting point for this is, how long does it take you to write an issue, one single issue of a book?
I would say for Green Lantern Corps, usually it takes a few days, start to finish. For The Flash, on the other hand, Rob and I are co-writing The Flash now, and it takes about half a day for me to do my half of an issue of The Flash. And I finally realized the thing that makes Flash so much easier and so much faster is it's just one guy who's on Earth who his power is that he runs really fast. Whereas Green Lantern Corps, you know, there's always new alien planets. There's this crazy, long, convoluted history, and there are thousands, I mean, literally thousands of characters. So, you know, I love both of the books, but Green Lantern Corps, just because of how big it is and how much stuff there is to handle, it's quite a bit more work.
Let's talk about Green Lantern Corps, because that's where I first jumped on the Van Jensen bandwagon, so to speak. And as you started with episode 21, or episode issue 21, do you find that it's easier to kind of write an issue now that you're a little bit more rooted into the story, into the characters?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I jumped in and I had very, very little clue what I was doing. And so it was a really, really steep learning curve at the start. But it, you know, every issue you just pick up more stuff, and of course, you know, more and more familiarity and comfort with the characters and comfort with their voices. And so even just in building up my own history and my own stories, that it's easier to remember stuff that I created than it is to, you know, fall back on something that was written a few years ago by someone else. So every little bit makes it easier. It's kind of interesting. You know, some issues go really smoothly and are really easy to write, and then some are just kind of bears that you just have to knuckle down and power through them.
Now, it seems about a year ago or so, they all four Green Lanterns, well, I guess we could say five with Simon Baz, but the four that a lot of people are familiar with, of course, Hal Jordan, John Stewart, Guy Gardner, Kyle Rayner, they were kind of floating in and out of each other's realms, but it seems in the last year or so, every one of those has their own voice and their own title. And spoilers for anybody out there, but Guy Gardner's a Red Lantern now. Kyle Rayner is the White Lantern and is in the New Guardians. Then, of course, Hal Jordan in Green Lantern. And John Stewart has kind of been a focal point, at least from an Earthling standpoint, in Green Lantern Corps.
Yeah, and that was something that was very direct and purposeful on behalf of the DC editors. They realized that the Earth Lanterns had been competing for limelight in all of the different books, and that, you know, John Stewart, I would say especially, but really all of the characters were kind of struggling to be a strong focus. I mean, Hal, of course, you know, is the major focus, so not as much for him. And, you know, Kyle had mostly been the focus of New Guardians, but there were a lot of other characters there that were kind of crowding the limelight. And then John and Guy were both, you know, both the focus of Green Lantern Corps, but really I'd say most of the focus went to Guy. So they realized, you know, we have these four books and these four, you know, more notable Earth Lanterns. Of course, Simon Boz has been a major player in Justice League and some of those books. So I just felt really lucky to be able to be the writer to focus on John Stewart. He was a character that, I mean, I had known him as Green Lantern from, you know, reading Green Lantern at the time that I did growing up. It was a character I'd always really liked. You know, there were, I remember growing up and stumbling upon some issues of Green Lantern Mosaic, which is a really trippy John Stewart story. And I mean, I must have been like 8 or 9 when those came out. And, you know, I didn't totally get it, but I really loved the complexity of the character that it represented. So for me, you know, it couldn't have worked out better. And hopefully fans feel the same way, that, you know, you can see all of these characters grow and develop in their own books.
Now, while you mention John Stewart and catching some John Stewart in publication when you were young, did you ever come across the Hal Jordan, Oliver Queen, Green Lantern, Green Arrow books?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It wasn't actually until a little bit later that I went back and read some of that. I'm trying to think. It was maybe post-college when some of that started to be reprinted that I caught a little of it. And it's certainly some dated comics, but they have a great focus. And I love the, you know, the fact that they have such strong themes and messaging throughout.
Pretty powerful social commentary, and I remember, and I'm not going to quote it right, but there's one point where Green Arrow and Green Lantern are in, I don't want to say a mob, but they're in a group, and one of these individuals, you know, saying to Green Lantern, who of course spends a lot of his time off world, he's like, you can help the blues and the greens and the purple people, but what about us, you know, type of thing. So it big social commentary, and maybe even, would you say, was a bit ahead of its time?
Yeah, I think especially for superhero comics, it was. And, you know, I'm not going to claim to be any kind of a thorough historian of comics enough to say that definitively. But, you know, the thing about it is those stories still hold up. And I think that they kind of, you know, foretold a time when superhero comics would really take geopolitical matters and cultural matters very seriously and delve into them in complex and interesting ways. And certainly I think it's something for all writers to aspire to.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the recent history of the Green Lantern Corps. In the last 12 months, they have been busy. Their homeworld, Oa, destroyed by Relic. And Relic, of course, used in this, again, spoilers, we're talking about issues that have been out there, so if you haven't picked up these, you're going to have to go back and or pause this, fast forward for a few minutes while we talk about the recent history of Green Lantern Corps. But Relic was an individual from, quote-unquote, the a previous universe, and he kind of came through into what we know as our universe, or the DC universe, and wreaked all kinds of havoc because he believed that the power rings wielded by Green Lanterns, Blue Lanterns, Red Lanterns, etc., were draining and were going to cause another collapse of the universe, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And the Relic character was part of the pitch that that Rob Venditti made to get the job writing Green Lantern. That was, you know, the storyline that he wanted to jump out of the gate with. And it's just an amazingly complex and interesting character. And you have to love a villain who is really justified in his actions, and he's doing bad things and going about it in a pretty dire way that certainly the Green Lantern Corps isn't very happy with. But you can't really say that his aims are bad ones. He's trying to do the right thing. It's just being pretty damaging in how he goes about it.
And it seems the Green Lanterns can't catch a break, because before it was Relic, then there was the Wrath of the First Lantern. What we've seen in the last year or so now is Oa is gone. The Guardians, as we know them, are gone. There's kind of a new batch of Guardians, oddly enough, mostly in the title, Green Lantern New Guardians. They're with Kyle Rayner and Carol Ferris, the Star Sapphire. What we're seeing in Green Lantern Corps since the Relic, even a little bit during the period of the storyline with Relic, but kind of a sabotaging from within. And I know you dropped the name last time we talked, the Durlans. They are a shifty, shape-shifting race of aliens, and they have caused some troubles here for the Corps.
Yeah, that was a storyline that I was really excited to explore in the book. And the Durlans, the premise is that they're shapeshifters, and they have been shapeshifters for so long that they don't actually have a native form. They are always either in a state of flux or, you know, taking on the form of some other species, and they have sort of this ancient grudge against the Green Lantern Corps. And I just really like the idea of a society that everything about them, both their appearance and their actions, is based entirely on deception. And it was something that, you know, we got to explore in a big way. And one of the things that was a lot of fun with it is that, you know, a lot of times in superhero comics, it's kind of characters flying at each other, punching each other in the head, which, you know, nothing wrong with characters punching each other in the head. but we, you know, we wanted to have this giant epic battle going on, but the Green Lanterns don't even know that the fight has already started.
A bit more cerebral.
Yeah. Everything is deception, and it's, you know, the Durlans are playing chess, and the Green Lanterns don't even know that they're playing a game.
And it's one of those two ties in very well with the Relic story, because and I've been behind. I apologize, but I've been playing catch up the last few days and trying to get, you know, my stack of yet to read a lot smaller than my stack of already done reading. The Durlans, the Coons, the Braidsmen, all these tribes that the Durlans are kind of allying themselves with against the Green Lantern Corps, they are using Relic's technology. So again, it kind of plays into that recent history that we saw. I believe it was last fall when that Relic story kind of wrapped up. But all playing into that, and using that light draining or that power draining technology, and I hate to sound repetitive when I say wreak havoc or cause problems, but they have so far proved to be a little bit more than the Green Lanterns can handle.
Yeah, and things things just get worse and worse, really, which, you know, always seems to be the case with the Green Lantern Corps. Right now we're getting close to the end of the Uprising story arc, which was a six-part crossover between Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps, which runs through Green Lantern 31 through Green Lantern Corps 33. So the number 33 issues are coming out in the next couple of weeks. And it's really the war has finally started for real, and the Green Lanterns discover that the Durlans have, in a lot of ways, the Durlans have already fought the war and won, and turned the universe against the Green Lanterns, which, you know, raises another interesting question for the Green Lantern Corps, which is, how do you police a universe that doesn't really want your help? And these are, you know, huge, huge issues that have major ramifications for the Corps. And And we're also going to see for Jon Stewart personally some big fallout from what the Durlans have been doing. That's, you know, there's actually some stuff that some kind of seeds that were planted in the very first issue that I started on, issue 21, that next month they're finally gonna, you know, be revealed what's been building this whole time.
A lot of people have been talking about issue number 30. You have kind of a on the cover, by the way, brilliant cover. Can you tell me who did the cover for Green Lantern Corps 30?
That was Bernard Chang, who's okay. the ongoing series artist for the book.
The cover has Jon Stewart, his Green Lantern uniform, jersey, whatever you want to call it, being held by what you think is another Green Lantern. He's kind of down, looks like he's unconscious, but it's clear that the Green Lantern is only a Green Lantern in disguise. It's actually a Durlan, but we can't see the faces covered up, so we don't know exactly who that is. You're not going to tell me, are you?
Yeah, you know, there are quite a few Durlans who were able to get Green Lantern rings, which is a pretty big reveal that I guess that finally was shown in Green Lantern Corps 29. And, you know, it seems like that's probably the worst of what the Durlans could possibly do, but you're about to find out that they could actually do a little bit worse than that.
And one of the things is we kind of close out our Green Lantern Corps discussion, but I love the setting, the new home for the Green Lanterns. I love the fact that it's Mogo, a sentient planet, because Mogo is... You take away, you know, the Hal Jordan, Jon Stewart, Kilowog. Mogo's definitely in my he's definitely my top 10 and probably a little higher than that as far as favorite Green Lanterns.
Yeah, Mogo's such a cool character and just such a cool concept, which, I mean, like so many concepts in comics, all owes to Alan Moore. But, yeah, it, you know, it was something that early on when we started working on Lights Out, we realized that the story would naturally lead to Oa being destroyed. And we started to talk about this idea of Mogo as the home base for the Lanterns and looking at Mogo as almost like an aircraft carrier. And it just seemed like such a cool idea. And thankfully DC was on board with it. And we were at Heroes Con last year, actually, all the Green Lantern writers. And we had a panel, and we were talking about stuff upcoming in the book, and we had just, you know, worked out all the logistics of getting the core based on Mogo. And at this panel, someone in, you know, one of the attendees stood up to ask a question, and he said, you know, you guys should really, you should put the Green Lantern core on Mogo. And we all just laughed and was like, yeah, that's a good idea. Someone should write that down.
And what I found was funny is just kind of Mogo's way of seeing things is that you would think that his Green Lantern powering would be buried in a cave or in the center of his world, something like that. But it was out in the forest. I think there was a small squirrel-like creature that was playing it. And Mogo's like, I don't see anything wrong with that. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's not going anywhere.
That was totally Rob's idea, which that, and also, you know, all the interactions between Mogo and St. Walker now that St. Walker has lost his hope and lost his blue ring and all of that stuff, those scenes I just love, and, you know, Rob's done a great job with them.
Because Robert did take over the Green Lantern title about 8 months ago, probably?
Yeah, so we all the creators changed over on with issue 21. So issue 21 of Green Lantern was Rob's first issue.
Okay, so he was doing dual work between Green Lantern and Green Lantern Corps, at least initially. Now, Green Lantern Corps Bernard Chang's been doing a lot, but he's certainly not been the only artist, correct?
Yeah, and you know, it's unfortunate that we've had to switch up the art a little bit, and the thing that happened was I was hired pretty late in the process for issue 21. So we kind of got behind just right out of the gate. So, you know, Bernard, to his credit, has done as much as he can possibly do to do as much as he can. It was really, you know, a situation that was totally out of his hands. So we have had to have some fill-in art. And, you know, it's, I love Bernard's art. I really, you know, would love for him to draw every page of every superhero comic I ever do. But, obviously that's not possible. But the nice thing about it is I've gotten a chance to work with quite a few other people. You know, Scott Collins, Scott Hanna, really just quite a few other great creators, and it's been a cool honor to work with some of the people who, you know, either I grew up reading or I've known of their work for years.
And how does that go from getting your thoughts? Do you send a pretty detailed script, or do you kind of give them a rough outline and leave it in their hands?
Yeah, I work by full script, and that's just, you know, largely because this was my first work in superhero comics, I wasn't comfortable working from a rough or an outline style. A lot of guys do that. It's just, you know, I wanted to really learn and develop as a writer, and I felt like, you know, the best way for me to do that was through writing full scripts. So I'm pretty detailed. I try not to be absurdly detailed. I actually, fairly early on, the editors told me I could dial it back on the details a little bit. So I'm trying not to be quite as verbose. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just page by page, panel by panel, a full description of everything going on. And then, of course, you know, we work with the editors to make sure that, you know, we get it in a good place. And then there's also, there are a lot of changes that happen, you know, with the art team, and Bernard especially, he really has a very strong storytelling sense. And so he'll make changes as he goes along that just strengthen the story in every way.
One more Green Lantern Corps, I promise, and then we'll move on and start talking about the Flash. But Green Lantern Corps number 25, It came under the Batman Zero-Year banner, and it's strictly a pre-ring-slinging John Stewart. What can you tell me the difference between writing that kind of story versus writing one where he's got these infinite powers of will?
Yeah, that was a really fun assignment, and one that we all thought pretty outside the box on crossing over Green Lantern Corps with Batman. But, you know, John Stewart had never gotten a number zero issue. And actually, I think you might have asked me when I was on the show the first time if I was going to do a zero issue origin story for John Stewart. And I was pretty sure at that time that it wasn't in the plans, but obviously we ended up doing it. So, you know, it was a story that, as weird as it sounds to cross Green Lantern Corps over with Batman, it was actually pretty organic. And it was something that was completely our, you know, our idea, something that we approached the Batman group with, and thankfully they were comfortable with. But it was a very, very different story. And I wanted it to be a story without a Green Lantern ring anywhere in the issue. And I think there were some Green Lantern fans that weren't that happy with that. That, you know, they felt like it wasn't a real Green Lantern story. But to me, what makes a Green Lantern is always the characteristics that lead them to be chosen. And that was what I really wanted to explore. You know, what is it that makes John Stewart worthy of a ring, rather than, you know, what were the actual mechanics of him getting his ring? And it ended up being a pretty complicated story because there were sort of three concurrent timelines going on and layers of narration and overlapping plot threads and, you know, all of this like thematic mirroring between different timelines. So I don't know, it was a challenging issue to write, but one that I'm really proud of.
You mentioned timelines, which I think is a perfect way to segue from Green Lantern Corps to The Flash, who right now is, you know, you open up, you know, I think it was The Flash Annual number three, and you see various timelines. But before we get into the specifics, how did that change come about as far as you and Robert going over to The Flash? Was that something that you guys pursued, or did DC come did DC contact you about it?
DC initially went to Rob and asked if he would be interested in taking over the book. And he's been pretty busy with a lot of stuff lately, but he also, you know, we had really enjoyed working together on the Green Lantern stuff. And we were kind of looking for an opportunity to work together again. And so, you know, Rob told DC that he would be interested, but it was only going to work out if he and I could work together. And, you know, DC was happy to do that. I think they had seen the work that we could do on the Green Lantern books. And so I guess it was late last fall that we started to actually plan the storyline and put that together. And, you know, it's as simple as Flash is, and that it's just a guy who runs fast. Of course, we decided to work on a story that involves time travel. So I don't know. I guess we couldn't make it too easy on ourselves.
It's kind of like it. Now I'll say this: the only Flash I ever picked up before the Flash 30, because I'm a pandering son of a buck, was Flashpoint, which of course penned by Geoff Johns, and it was a bit of a catalyst, in my opinion, that brought about the new 52. It was a nice way to wrap up the old and open up the new. You jump in on issue number 30, and like I said, that came out in April. How long, I guess, when did you first find out that you'd be working on The Flash? How long of a buildup was there?
I can't remember exactly when it was that the approval came through, but it was like late fall, early winter, I guess. And so then, you know, the issue came out in April. So there were about, you know, 5-6 months of working on it, you know, building out the storyline and then getting started on actually writing the scripts and working with Brett Booth, Norm Ratmond, and Andrew Dahlhaus, the art team. So it was, you know, I was really kind of in a lot of ways thrown to the wolves with Green Lantern Corps. So it was great with The Flash to have the time to really, you know, put stuff together and think through the story and very much develop the plot, which, you know, I enjoy both, but I guess The Flash was a little more relaxed and very ironically more slow moving.
Now you pick it up after I guess it'd probably be the conclusion of Forever Evil, and the crime syndicate. So you have basically similarly powered individuals to what we know as the Justice League, but with a completely different personality. So they have wreaked havoc. There I go again. That's apparently going to be the subtitle of this episode. But Central City is in bad shape, and Barry Allen gets the call.
Yeah. I don't know. It's you know, it's just a total honor to write a character like Barry Allen, and I mean such a legacy there. And you know, I just got the chance to hang out in Phoenix with Brian Augustine, who was the editor on The Flash during the seminal, you know, Mark Waid run, and then I actually got to see Mark at HeroesCon. And so there's just this real sense of responsibility that comes with writing that character. And also, you know, I love the aspect of The Flash being set sort of in the Midwest. You know, Central City is, I've always heard it referred to as kind of being an analog of St. Louis. And so, you know, I try to bring as many of those kind of cultural idioms and little bits of Midwest flavor into the book as possible.
Now, we started, and I've got to ask this question right off the bat, because Barry receives a watch as a gift from his girlfriend, and after doing some of his speed running, there seems to be a time discrepancy between the watch and the actual time. Will that be fleshed out in some upcoming stories as to why that is?
Yeah. So that's really central to, it's kind of the big mystery to this first arc, which, you know, why is it that whenever Barry taps into the Speed Force that he loses time? And it ties directly into the future Flash, who, you know, we encounter 20 years into the future, who is a very disillusioned and broken person. And so then that mystery is, you know, what has happened that has made future Flash, you know, so dark and so jaded and so willing to go to extreme measures to achieve the ends that he wants to achieve. And those two things really drive directly into each other and will all culminate in the September Future's End, the Flash number one, and then Flash 35 in October.
Now, it might be an entirely too simplistic view of it, but you have someone from a, I guess we could probably call Future Flash from a dystopian future, going back, and again, not to spoil it for anybody who hasn't read it, but if you've read, I believe it was annual number 3, you find out what Future Flash's intent is, and it's kind of the reverse of, and I'm just gonna pull this one out because it's been in the news recently because of the movie, but kind of a reverse of the Days of Future Past, where you know, they send back in the movie, it's Wolverine or his consciousness to stop an assassination, whereas the Flash has a different intent.
Yeah. So, you know, with the story building up, there's something that was broken far in the past, and Future Flash is on a mission to solve it, and he knows that this puts him directly at odds with a past version of himself. So he certainly is not on an altruistic journey into the past.
What I like about Future is you've still got Gorilla Grodd. He's hanging out there, and he has handled, I believe he put it as the smartest man in from the 25th century, Professor Zoom. Now, because I have not been reading The Flash, how did Gorilla Grodd get the powers of the Speed Force?
The idea that's there in the issue is he, and all of this is stuff that hasn't been seen, so this is stuff that's kind of new to our arc, that, you know, Gorilla Grodd has the powers of the Speed Force, and at some indeterminate time in the future, because of course, this is a little gross maybe, but Gorilla Grodd gains the powers of other by consuming their brains. So Gorilla Grodd has at some point consumed the brain of Daniel West, who is Reverse Flash, and Reverse Flash has the ability to travel through time. So Gorilla Grodd now as well has the ability to travel through time and has been using it to kind of amass riches and wealth for himself, at least until Future Flash arrives to stop him.
I like how Grodd explains it. He's gone back and sort of single-handedly saved the library of Alexandria and just all of these, all of this important history and knowledge from the ancient world, from, you know, our modern world. He kind of puts, he's like, I'm the smartest being there is, and you can't kill me, otherwise there will, you know, all of this knowledge will be lost forever, type of thing.
Yeah, that's, you know, a cool thing about that character, and that was a scene that was written by Rob, so I can't really claim credit for it, but just this idea that he, you know, he's a gorilla who really wants to be a human, and so much of what he does is predicated on being smarter and being perceived as smart and showing off how smart he is, when, you know, at the end of the day, as Future Flash says, he's just a, you know, big gorilla with fat gorilla fingers, which ultimately does Grodd in.
Also, in very early on in your run, obviously we're only if you include the annual, I believe 3 issues in to your run on The Flash. But in that annual, Wally West got introduced in the New 52 universe. What brought about the decision to bring back that character?
Yeah, that was something that was presented to us by DC with the TV show coming up on the CW and Wally West being a central part of the show. DC felt like it was the right time to reintroduce him in the book. And, you know, to me, it was a really cool opportunity. I mean, how often do you get the chance to introduce a character with a legacy like Wally West? So, you know, we really had the entire storyline figured out at that point, but Rob and I were able to take Wally and we felt like pretty seamlessly work him into the book and figure out some ways that he could make the book even stronger than it already was. And I do think that the book's a lot better for having him there.
How long has Ben Van since Wally was in publication? I mean, he's been out of stories for some time, correct?
Yeah, he had not made an appearance in the New 52, but he was present at the end of the Old 52. So I guess that would be, was that about 4 years ago now, or 3.5 years ago?
Yeah, I'd say pretty close to 2011, maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, so we're coming up on 3 years.
And now, whose decision was it? Was it yours and Robert's from a writing standpoint or an artist's take? But this is not the Wally West that comics readers were familiar with pre-52.
Yeah, that was something that also came from DC. They really wanted to, you know, take the chance to reintroduce a character and a very well-known and beloved character, and use that as an opportunity to add some diversity to the line and really to reflect the diversity of the society that we live in. And so Wally West, he's younger than the character that we left off in the Old 52. He's 12 years old and he's mixed race. His dad is white and his mom is black. And, you know, to me, I am 100% in support of it. I think it was a great move. I think if anything, the New 52 could have been even more diverse. And, you know, really what matters most with people is what your character is and what you are below the skin. It's something that I believe, you know, very thoroughly. And so it's something that, you know, for Rob and I, Wally's race is not any kind of a central focus in terms of the scripting. It's all about, you know, who he is as a character and where he's going as a character and how he relates to the other people, especially Barry.
Now, that was one decision after it was announced that Wally West wouldn't be the same Wally West that, you know, people were familiar with. There was some, not all of the reaction to that was positive. Did you happen to see any of the internet tough guys out there, you know, saying, well, I'm not going to buy the book or just any of that negative reaction?
Yeah, there was some of that. I mean, you know, on Twitter, I guess I saw a few people send in kind of, I'll generously say, nasty notes. And I saw there was one person who actually wrote, there's like on the White House website, there's a place where you can write a petition. And so some clever individual decided that they should write a petition to the president to try to, you know, get him to force DC Comics to make Wally West white again, which I thought was fairly ironic since the current president is our first president of mixed race, you know, but there are always people on the internet who are upset about things. And so, you know, on the whole, I felt like the response was really positive and even way more positive than I'd kind of braced myself, for worse. So ultimately it's been really reassuring. And I think, you know, I think the character has resonated, and I've heard from, you know, kids who are from a similar background, who, you know, look at that character and really identify with the new Wally West in a way that they couldn't with a lot of superhero characters before. And so, you know, that's all stuff that's really cool. And I think it shows that DC chose really wisely when they made this decision.
And it seems to be something, a trend that's happening a lot more in comics. And I don't think it's being done to, you know, appease various sections of the population. But I think it's being done because we are a much more diverse society than, you know, we were probably when you know, certainly when, you know, Batman and Superman were first created, were a lot different than we were back then, and same for the Flash and Green Lantern. So diversity, I don't think any diversity in comics is bad, because everybody's looking for that character or characters that they can relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not even necessarily that, I mean, society is more diverse now, but even beyond that, just the cultural norms, what they were in the 1940s especially, you really could not have a primary character in a comic book who was a minority. That just would not have been possible to do. And so, you know, it's just by the nature of the way that things were at that time, all of these old legacied superheroes are uniformly white. And that is just in no way reflective of the world that we live in. And I always feel like the goal as a creator is to make comics or make books or make whatever that everyone can identify with and that everyone can connect with in some way. And every step towards that, I do believe is a good step.
Now, I said, you know, a few moments ago that the only Flash that I had read prior to the Flash number 30 was Flashpoint. After you know, heard from DC that you'd be writing Flash, did you start to kind of go back and read some of the new 52, some of the pre-52 Flash stuff, just to kind of figure out where they were in the story and how you were going to pick it up?
Yeah. I'm pretty big on research and writing, in part because I want to make sure that the continuity is right, and I don't want to leave all of that on the editor. And then also, you know, you never know what little story beats that were unresolved at some point in the past will be something that you can explore and mine in the future. And I think that's kind of the best sort of world building in comics, is always looking back to past continuity for opportunities to further explore and to even to take little incongruities or things that seem illogical and to try to, you know, explain them. So I read a lot of the Silver Age stuff. I read all of the New 52 stuff. I've read through, I haven't tracked down all of the trades, but I've read through most of Mark Waid's run and all of Geoff Johns's run, and some of, there was a brief Grant Morrison, Mark Miller run. So not to say that I've read every Flash comic that's ever been written, but I've gotten through a pretty big pile of them.
Now, a couple of moments ago, you mentioned Wally West, bringing him back into the books because he's going to be playing a part on the Flash TV show coming this fall to the CW. Because you are writing for the Flash, has DC asked you, if gauged your interest on doing any screenwriting for television for the Flash?
I wish. Nah, I haven't heard anything to this point. I don't expect to, because they're pretty separate worlds. But of course, you know, if the opportunity ever arose to work in TV, that's something that I would love to do. But we've had some communication. It's not like we're doing an adaptation of the TV show or they're directly adapting what we're doing in any way, because they are mostly separate entities. But there's, you know, a lot of respect there, and we know that, you know, a great comic feeds a great TV show and vice versa. And there has been a little talk about potentially using a character that we created in the TV show. So we'll wait and see if that happens, but that would be a pretty cool moment if that did come about.
Well, even Jeff Johns got to write an episode or two of Smallville, so let's not hold out hope just yet, Van.
Yeah, well, I am clearly no Jeff Johns, but I appreciate it.
Let's transition to Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. We talked about it at the top of the show. We talked about it certainly 20 episodes ago, 20 technically, but of course part 15 or episode 15 was split between parts 1 and 2. So anyway, back at episode 1, we learned about Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, its origins, and I like how you took the initial story and kind of framed it out for us in the opening pages of Pinocchio Vampire Slayer, so we could get a better understanding of why Pinocchio is the way he is, and it didn't have a singing, hopeful Jiminy Cricket. It just had Cricket, who, as you said last time we talked, gets killed very early into the story.
Yeah, it's a very different book, definitely. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a story that I'm still really proud of, and one that was always intended to be one big adventure. And so, actually, just last week we released the complete edition of Pinocchio Vampire Slayer from Top Shelf Productions, which is a company in Marietta, really close to here, and a publisher that I've always really respected a lot, and am very honored to, you know, have a book with them. And so it's I don't know, it's interesting looking back at it, because it I think it ended up that it's about 540 pages of comics.
The complete, I did a little research on it last week. The complete is massive.
Yeah, it's a big book, although it, you know, it only costs, I think it's like $25. So, you know, the per page right there is a pretty good bang for the buck. But yeah, it's, you know, it's just a big, fun, really weird story. And I always wanted it to be something that people could read all at once. And, you know, now finally you can. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm really, really happy to have it out there.
I read, I guess, volume one, the beginning arc, in two sittings. And I'm not going to spoil it for the listeners, because I really want them to go check it out. But that twist at the end was shocking to me. I was it's a good thing I was sitting down to find out who was, and this is no pun intended, but who was pulling the strings there. And I'll say this, and it was a wordless page, but it might have been my favorite panel in the entire first volume. No words, full page panel. And it was the one, kind of the setting sun, perhaps, but it was Pinocchio right after he had been hanged in the woods. Just I thought it was beautifully done by Dustin, and one of those where you don't need any words for it. But I thoroughly enjoyed the story that I've read of it so far. I can't wait to keep reading the story.
I appreciate it. I mean, you know, it was a very silly premise, and something that, you know, we knew could kind of go overly in that direction of being too goofy. And so we worked hard to have that balance where, you know, we wanted it to be a very serious story that people could really connect with and that could have kind of that emotional impact. And I don't know, I'm glad that it resonated with people in that way. And, you know, the complete edition, it ended up kind of randomly, Dusty and I met Mike Carey, the writer, who, you know, of course has done amazing, amazing work. You know, The Unwritten, which is one of my favorite comic book series, and, Lucifer, and a lot of great work on X-Men and so many other titles. And, we gave him copies of the books, and he really loved them, and he actually wrote an introduction for us for the complete edition. And, you know, to have someone like Mike Carey, who I really revere as a writer, who, you know, is writing so many nice things about this book that we did, it's, I don't know, very, very much an honor, but also really surreal.
And again, from a premise that was very fanciful or whimsical, but a very serious story, once you get into it, some of the parts that I like, the banter between Pinocchio and the creatures who I guess would be considered the vampires, because as we discussed last year, he can, you know, tell a lie, grow his nose, snap it off, stab somebody, and go on. He's got this endless supply of ammunition, but even some of the lies that he's telling, you know, they're giving him crap for it. They're like, that's just contrived, you know. Can you got anything better?
yeah, that was, of course, you know, something that was a lot of the fun of the book was kind of thinking about what's a lie, what isn't a lie, and how do we frame that. And I don't know, it was a really, really fun book to write, and when it was done, I don't know, I really missed the characters a lot. And so we did a little one-shot, single-issue, like 30-page story that is going to be published probably later this year. So, you know, we were able to go back to it a little bit. But, you know, I don't know that we'll ever revisit it. I love how the series ends. And so, you know, we'll just wait and see.
Does your one-shot include a dystopian future with Pinocchio 20 years down the road?
Unfortunately not.
All right. One of the things that we discussed at the end of our last meeting back in episode one, and giving you a little heads up in the emails back and forth, we got to talk about some of your favorite comic books of all time, be it, you know, works that are highly revered, you know, seminal works of various characters, or just ones that you, when you have time and you know, feel like, you know, getting into comics for that recreational aspect, things that you just could read over and over. So if you've got them, I'd like to know, you know, a few of your favorite comic books, Van.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would start with the original Larry Hama run on G.I. Joe. It was the comics that I read growing up, that we didn't get very many comics in Llewellyn, Nebraska, but that was one of them and was very formative. And just, you know, it was a simple action story, but it had a lot of really cool stuff going on that was way bigger and a lot more, I don't know, just way more compelling and better than it needed to be. I really love the Owly series of graphic novels, which are these wordless all-ages books published by Top Shelf that my friend Andy Rutten does. They're just incredibly sweet and charming and beautifully illustrated. The Unwritten by Mike Carey, I think if you're a reader, if you love books, it's one of the best comics that has ever been created. Let's see, what else? A great series that's ongoing right now, my buddy Matt Kent has a series called Mind Management that's super trippy and weird and fun. If you like superhero stuff, I would say check out Exo Manowar and Harbinger from Valiant. They relaunched a couple of years ago, and they've been putting out some really great comics.
It's funny that you mentioned Matt Kent and Mind Management. Last time we talked, and I don't know, this might have been, I'm not sure if this part made it in to the final cut or not. I know you mentioned him when we were talking about some of the top nerds a year ago. That was a very short-lived end of the interview series here on Nerds United. But you mentioned Matt Kent, and I did a little research. I finally got to the first volume of Mind Management, and it is a massive work to try to get through. I haven't even opened it up yet, but and Matt, he's a difficult guy to get a hold of for an interview. So, those are I like that, that your list is original. It's not, you know, you could have gone with, oh, The Dark Knight Returns and All-Star Superman, but it's, you know, this is your list, man. It speaks to you. It's good stuff. Hopefully, you know, the listeners out there, they will take that and pick up on it. Maybe go and search some of those titles out to themselves. That's how I came across Mind Management from our last conversation, and I get a lot of the comics that I end up buying or bringing home come from other podcasts and you know, other recommendations. So hopefully some of the listeners out there, they go and they find some of those titles that you mentioned. So Van, we've been talking almost an hour now. It's crazy.
Time just flies by when we're together, Greg.
It sure does. But I want to thank you again so much for taking time out, because it's, you know, you're an hour ahead. You're in prime time family time right now, and I'm stealing you away. So I do apologize for that. But I do thank you for joining me. We might have to get together again next June.
I think we should make it a tradition.
Every June. Greg Mahochko, Van Jensen on Nerds United. Van, thank you so much again, sir. And I've enjoyed the conversation. I enjoy reading the works that you've put out. I enjoyed that I sent you a variant copy of Green Lantern Corps 21, I believe, and sent it to you, and you autographed it and sent it back, and we were able to give that away as a prize here on Nerds United. So thank you for all that you've done for the show. And who knows, maybe this time next year we'll finally be on iTunes. Because we're still not yet.
It sounds like a plan.
All right, Van, thanks again. That is Van Jensen. He writing for Green Lantern Corps, The Flash, both for DC. You've got to go out and check out the complete Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. I assure you, you won't be disappointed. And Van, they can probably get that at their local comic book store, at least get it ordered through their local comic book store, but I believe they can also pick it up through Amazon. Where other what other areas or sources can they acquire the complete Pinocchio Vampire Slayer?
Yeah, it's on Amazon or at any, you know, comic shop or bookstore. You'll be able to find it or order it, and yeah, absolutely, let your retailers know about it. And then it's also available digitally through Comixology and all of the other digital comics channels.
Perfect. Again, I encourage you to check out Pinocchio Vampire Slayer. I took my volume one. I've already lent it to a friend, so I might tell him to keep that, and I'll just go buy the entire thing. So that works for him. That works for me, because I love passing on comics. Van, thanks again, and best of luck, sir, and we'll talk in the near future.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
That is Van Jensen, and again, check out van.dot. Jensen, jensen.tumblr.com. You can see his Tumblr. You can get all of his works. You can also find his bio on Comic Vine. What a fantastic guy, fantastic guest. And that does it for episode 21 of Nerds United.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.